Kirk, this is Democracy Now!
We want to say that we are protesting the fact that 1,400 children are going to be brought to this military site. We're here because we do not want to have that happen. And as former children of prison camps, of concentration camps in America, we are saying no more, never again.
Japanese Americans who survived living in U.S. internment camps during World War II returned to the site of one of those camps, Fort Sill in Oklahoma, to protest the Trump administration's plan to indefinitely detain 1,400 immigrant and refugee children there. We'll air a special report from the Oklahoma protest. But first, we speak to an attorney who helped expose how some 250 infants, children, and teenagers have been locked up for weeks without adequate food, water, and sanitation at a Border Patrol station near El Paso, Texas. We'll talk to her about children taking care of children. And then we go to Ecuador to speak with the Swedish computer programmer Ola Bini, who was just released from jail after being held for 2 months without charge.
We have proven my innocence for the first time, and we will continue to prove my innocence. I want to thank the judges for showing what we've been saying the whole time, that this process has been illegal and that I was illegally detained.
Ola Bini was detained in Ecuador on the same day his friend Julian Assange was arrested and forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy in London, removed to the Belmarsh prison. Ola Bini will join us from Quito, Ecuador. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Trump administration's reportedly launched cyber attacks against Iran is announcing a new wave of sanctions today. This comes days after President Trump abruptly called off military strikes against Iran. Trump said he called off the attack after he was told it could kill 150 Iranians. Trump and members of his administration said they would be open to holding negotiations with Iranian leadership, but Iran has said they will not negotiate as long as sanctions are still active. Meanwhile, an Iranian news outlet reported the country's naval chief is warning it'll shoot down more U.S. drones after the disputed downing of the spy drone last week that Iran says entered its airspace, while the U.S. claims it was flying over international territory. In an interview with NBC's Meet the Press, Chuck Todd asked Trump whether he felt he was being pushed into military action by his advisors.
I have two groups of people. I have doves and I have hawks.
Yeah, you have some serious hawks.
I have
hawks.
Some hawks. Oh, yeah, John Bolton is absolutely a hawk. It's up to him. He'd take on the whole world at one time, okay? But that doesn't matter because I want both sides.
In immigration news, Immigration and Customs Enforcement announced Friday it would start a mass roundup of thousands of immigrants starting Sunday after the name Family App, saying it would take out families, targeting 10 cities. On Saturday, amidst national outcry, President Trump backtracked on the plan, saying he would delay the deportations by 2 weeks and put the onus on Democrats to make changes to immigration policy if they want to avoid thousands of families from being deported. But some media reports claim the delay was prompted by a leak by acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kevin McAleenan or his staff, which could have compromised the plan. Democratic lawmakers accuse the Trump administration of using the threat of mass deportations as a bargaining chip to push its immigration agenda. Texas Congressmember Joaquin Castro said the threat to knock and drag people away from their families and out of their communities shouldn't be a negotiation tactic for an American president, he said. A number of cities said they would not cooperate with ICE if they started to carry out mass removals. The Los Angeles Police Department tweeted it would not participate in any immigration enforcement activities, and the newly elected mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, announced she withdrew ICE's access to Chicago's police immigration databases. In other immigration news, Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced Friday he would deploy 1,000 additional National Guard troops to aid the federal government and what he calls the crisis at the border. New accusations of rape have been levied against President Trump. famed advice columnist and former television host E. Jean Carroll is accusing Trump of raping her in the 1990s in a dressing room at Bergdorf Goodman department store. Carroll writes Trump asked her to try on lingerie he was planning on buying as a gift before he entered a dressing room with her and forced himself on her, kissing and then raping her. Trump denied the accusation multiple times over the weekend and said he did not know and had never met Carroll, despite a photo which accompanied the book excerpt showing the two of them together at a party in the 1980s. At least 22 women have accused Trump of assault or sexual misconduct. In a now infamous Access Hollywood recording released in 2016 before the election, Trump boasts about his ability to sexually assault women. E. Jean Carroll, who's now 75, also accuses former CBS CEO Les Moonves of groping her in the elevator of a Beverly Hills hotel in the 90s after an interview. Moonves resigned last year from CBS while facing multiple sexual assault and sexual harassment allegations. In Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's AK party lost re-election after residents of Istanbul went to the polls for a second time and again voted an opposition candidate, Ekrem İmamoğlu, of the Republican People's Party, as the new mayor. The election do-over was called after the AKP first lost the crucial vote in March and alleged voting irregularities. The results bring to an end the 25-year rule by the AK party in Erdogan's home city of Istanbul. This is the new mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu.
This is a new beginning. I would like to say from here that as of tomorrow, I will treat 16 million people equally as mayor.
In Ethiopia, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said the Army Chief of Staff and another top military official were killed Saturday by the chief's bodyguard in connection with a failed coup attempt against the northern regional government of Amhara. The governor of Amhara was also killed earlier on Saturday. Internet access was cut off following the news, and checkpoints were set up around the capital, Addis Ababa. Prime Minister Ahmed says the attacks were not motivated by ethnic tensions, although few details are still known about the attempted coup perpetrators. Ahmed came to power last year and made history by signing a peace agreement with neighboring Eritrea. Ethnic conflict, however, continues to plague Ethiopia, causing massive displacement. Ahmed survived a grenade attack at a rally a year ago. Hundreds of activists entered and occupied an open pit coal mine in the western Rhineland region of Germany Saturday to protest Europe's dependency on fossil fuels amidst the mounting climate crisis. The protest ended Sunday after police repeatedly ordered them to leave, citing life-threatening danger. Some of the protesters were pulled out by authorities. The group was part of a larger gathering of an estimated 6,000 people who held several actions as part of the protest effort. Another group camped out on rail tracks leading to a coal-fired power station, blocking trains from entering or leaving the area. This is Catherine Henneberger, a member of the environmental group Ende Gelände, which coordinated the attacks.
More than 6,000 climate activists from across Europe were here in the Rhineland this weekend. We shut down the entire Rhineland region's lignite production. We are fighting for the immediate stop of coal production, but we have to do a lot more. We demand a different economic system, one that is socially fair and respects our planet's limits.
Catherine Henneberger, a member of the environmental justice group Ende Gelände, which coordinated the actions. You can see Democracy Now!'s reporting on the resistance against German coal mines from our COP23 coverage at our website, democracynow.org. In New York City, police arrested 70 climate activists from the group Extinction Rebellion Saturday as they called on the New York Times to up their coverage of the climate crisis and start using terms like climate emergency instead of climate change. Activists stopped traffic in the busy Midtown neighborhood, with some scaling the New York Times building and the Port Authority bus terminal to unfurl banners. The New York chapter of Extinction Rebellion recently shared a climate media standards guide, which includes changes to language, banning ads from fossil fuel companies, and linking weather-related stories to the climate crisis. Independent Senator, 2020 Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders is introducing legislation today that would cancel all $1.6 trillion of student loan debt in the United States, which affects around 45 million people. The measure would be paid for with a new tax on Wall Street. The bill will also make public universities and community colleges free, a key pillar of Sanders' education platform. Congressmembers Ilhan Omar and Pramila Jayapal are introducing accompanying legislation in the House. In Indiana, South Bend Mayor, 2020 presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg, is facing growing backlash from some of his constituents in the aftermath of the police shooting of Eric Logan, an African-American man killed by a white police officer last week. Buttigieg has left the campaign trail to return to his hometown, where some residents called him out for neglecting his duties as mayor during a tense town hall on Sunday. Frustrated citizens confronted the mayor about his track record on race-related issues and demanded transparency in Eric Logan's case.
The mayor, Rahm Emanuel, quit being the mayor because there was a cover-up. So I just want to make sure that you are aware that we're looking for no cover-up. We want transparency, total transparency. My sympathy and condolences to Eric's family. Eric Logan did not deserve to be treated like this.
People of color make up 40% of South Bend's population. Mayor Buttigieg acknowledged efforts to diversify and increase accountability in the South Bend police force had failed, and it was less diverse than he came into office 8 years ago. He's called for a Justice Department investigation into the shooting. The police officer was wearing body cam, but it was not turned on. Eddie Africa, a member of the Move 9, was released from a Pennsylvania prison Friday after spending 40 years behind bars. Eddie Africa was convicted along with eight others in the 1978 killing of police officer James Rapp. The nine were arrested following a Philadelphia police raid on the House of Move, a radical anti-police brutality and largely African-American organization. His release follows that of Janine Phillips Africa and Janet Holloway Africa last month. Husband and wife Mike Africa Sr. and Debbie Africa were both released last year. Two members of the group remain behind bars. And on Saturday, Japanese-American activists and survivors of U.S. internment camps engaged in civil disobedience outside Fort Sill Army Post in Oklahoma, where the Trump administration plans to indefinitely detain 1,400 immigrant and refugee children starting next month. Fort Sill was used as an internment camp for Japanese-Americans in 1942. This is Michael Ishii, who helped organize Saturday's protest.
I am here, a descendant to support my elders who have come to bear witness and to raise their collective voices in opposition to mass detention.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Outrage is mounting over deplorable and dangerous conditions for migrant children being jailed in detention facilities along the U.S.-Mexico border. Following a shocking Associated Press report late last week revealing at least 250 infants, children and teenagers been locked up for nearly a month without adequate food, water or sanitation at a Border Patrol station near El Paso, Texas. Lawyers who visited the facility in Clint, Texas, described a scene of chaos and sickness, with children unable to shower or change into clean clothes for weeks on end. The children have been reportedly fed uncooked frozen food or rice, and young children are being forced to care for infants and toddlers. One local lawyer said a sick two-year-old boy was being treated by three girls between the ages of 10 and 15 because no one else was helping him. Attorney Holly Cooper said, quote, "In my 22 years of doing visits with children in detention, I have never heard of this level of inhumanity," she said. This report came the same week the Trump administration argued in federal court the government's not required to provide toothbrushes, soap, or beds to children detained at the border. And as other reports found, similarly squalid conditions at a number of immigration jails. Lawyers who visited detained migrants at a processing center near McAllen, Texas, reported migrants, including young mothers and children, were jailed in unsanitary conditions, sometimes being forced to sleep outside due to overcrowding. For more, we go to Los Angeles, where we're joined by Warren Binford, a lawyer who interviewed children detained at the Clint, Texas facility. She's a law professor at Willamette University, director of its clinical law program. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Warren Binford. Can you describe why you went to Clint and what you found there? Describe your interviews with the children.
Well, basically, we went there because on an almost monthly basis, we are learning that children are dying in Border Patrol facilities all along the border, and we're trying to figure out what exactly is going on down there. So we sent a team of attorneys, doctors, interpreters to meet with the children and find out about the conditions in which they are being kept. We were not originally planning to go to the Clint Border facility outside of El Paso, Texas, because it's an adult facility. And the facility historically has had a relatively small occupancy, maximum of 104. However, we received reports last week that children appeared to be moving to this facility. And so what we did was we added it to our list of visits. And when we got there on Monday morning, we were immediately given a roster showing that there were over 350 children at this facility. And then when we scanned the roster, we were taken aback by the number of very young children at this facility. There were over 100 young children who were being kept there. And so we immediately asked the guards to start to bring us the youngest children and also the children who had been there the longest. We also saw that there were about a half a dozen child mothers and their infants. And so we asked the guards to also bring us those children. When the children walked into the conference room, we couldn't believe what we were seeing. They were sick. They were coughing. They had runny noses. They were filthy, dirty. And they immediately started to describe the level of hunger that they were experiencing. They told us that they were being fed nothing but the same meals three times a day. And they weren't really meals. These are frankenfood. These are highly processed chemical foods. In the morning, they are given instant oatmeal, a packet of Kool-Aid, and a cookie. For lunch, they are given instant soup, a cookie, and another packet of Kool-Aid. And then for dinner, they're given a frozen burrito in a plastic wrapper, similar to what you would see at a gas station. And some of the children complained that the burritos were often not thoroughly cooked. And then they also, at that point, are given another cookie and a Kool-Aid. Young children are being given this meal. Child mothers are being given this meal. And so the children, on a routine basis, said that they were hungry. On top of that, the children started to describe rooms in which there were 25, 50, 100 children. One boy said that when he first arrived there, there were over 300 children in a room. When we talked to the Border Patrol officers who are running this facility, they reported to us that the facility had recently undergone an expansion, but we couldn't figure out where that expansion was. So after that first day of interviewing, we drove around the facility and we saw a metal warehouse with no walls. And we couldn't believe that that possibly could be the expansion. But when we talked to the Border Patrol officers the next day and started to talk to the children about where they were being kept, we found out that, in fact, that one warehouse was allegedly what had given them an additional capacity of 500 additional children. So then what happened was, as we started to talk about the children, we asked them, who is taking care of you? And we found out that, in fact, virtually no one is taking care of these children directly, that they are locked up in these cells 24 hours a day. There are open toilets in many of these cells. There's no soap, no way to wash their hands. They're being fed in these cells, the processed instant foods that I described for you earlier. And many of them are being forced to sleep on concrete because of a shortage of beds and mats and sleeping space. Children describe sleeping on concrete floors. They describe sleeping on cement blocks. Not just the older children, but we heard of infants, toddlers, preschoolers, school-aged children who were having to sleep on the floor. to make things worse, as we were trying to call in the youngest children, because we were especially concerned about the vulnerabilities of certain elements of this population, we found out that there were a number of children that they could not bring to us because they were so sick. And so we started to count the number of children who apparently were sick at this facility and had been quarantined. And we estimated that at least 15 children that we knew about were in quarantine during the time that we were there. And when we finally got access to these children by telephone, we learned about the conditions in these quarantine facilities, which were just horrendous. These very sick children with high fevers are being put on the floor, on mats, largely unsupervised, locked up together for days at a time. They are being brought the same foods that are being fed to everybody else at the facility, despite the fact that they're very sick. They also have someone who is coming there twice a day to check their fever and to give them any medications that are needed. But there's nobody really caring for these children in the quarantine areas, despite their severe illness. Now, keep in mind that many of the children who have died in these Border Patrol facilities in recent months died from influenza, which is very, very rare in a developed country like the United States. But as you can see, these are not conditions that you would expect to see in the United States.
So do you believe some children can die there?
Absolutely. And that's why, after the second day of interviewing these children, we called up. We had a high-level, very urgent meeting in my hotel room and said, what are we going to do about this? Because somebody is going to die. And so we called up the attorneys who are in charge of this case, described what we were seeing, and then asked them what they wanted us to do about it. And for the first time in over 20 years of doing these visits, they told us to go ahead and go to the media so that we could get these children out of this facility as quickly as possible.
Can you talk about the lice and the lice combs?
Yes. Yes, yes. So let me tell you about this incident, because this was especially concerning. This visit was really originally scheduled for just 3 days. And what ended up happening was, when I was there on Wednesday, we started to hear from several children that there was an incident that had happened in one of the cells. And what the story was that there was a lice outbreak in one of the cells. Six of the children were found to have lice. Those six children were given lice shampoo, and then the other children were given two lice combs and told to pass those around and brush their hair with the lice combs in order to make sure that they, too, didn't have lice, or if they did, that the lice were being pulled out by the lice combs. Now, sharing lice combs, we all know, is something you never do with a lice infestation, but this is, in fact, what happened. But then the story gets worse, because one of the little kids lost the comb and the guards hit the roof. They yelled at the children and berated the children. They scared the children. They made the children cry. And then they took out all of the children's bedding. They took out the mats. They took out the blankets and told them that, as punishment for losing that comb, that they were going to have to sleep on the concrete that night. We could not believe that the guards really were going to do what they had threatened to the children that they would do. And so we arranged to come back the next day specifically to interview those children and find out if they had been made to sleep on the floor last night or if it was just an empty threat meant to scare the children. And in fact, we heard from multiple children that they, in fact, were forced to sleep on the floor that night in this cold cell, you know, on the cold concrete.
So the AP is reporting 1-year-old, 2-year-olds, 3-year-old, dozens more under 12, 15 have the flu, 19 more have been quarantined. And the reports of the 10-year-old taking care of the 2-year-old, handed the 2-year-old by a guard, along with two other kids under 15, that they're supposed to take care of a sick 2-year-old?
Yes, we saw multiple children, and not just the tweens and the teens taking care of young children. We saw school-aged children, 7 and 8 years old, who were trying to take care of the toddlers and the preschoolers, for the school-aged children, the ones who were about 7 and 8. There was one especially concerning little girl who had not showered or had her hair shampooed in so long that literally the hair on the back of her head was matted. And as a mom, I can assure you, they're are going to have to cut off all of her hair. When I saw the matting on her hair, I was so deeply concerned that I immediately went to the guards and said, you need to give this little girl a bath. You need to give her shampoo her hair. You need to put conditioner in there and detangler. You have to get this matting out of her hair. Otherwise, her whole head will have to be shaven. And so I came back the next day and asked if she had been given a bath and her hair shampooed. And I was assured that she had been. So I then called her and asked to see her. And when she was brought to me, she looked just as dirty. Her hair was just as matted as it was the day before. And so I called in one of the girls who had been helping to take care of her. And I said, tell me what's happening, because I'm being told by the guards that she had a shower yesterday or a bath. And she obviously hasn't. And that little girl who was about, I'd say probably 13, 14 years old, she told me that there was a 7 or 8 year old girl who was taking care of this little 4 year old girl the day before and was unable to persuade her to take a shower. And so they marked this dirty little 4 year old girl off as having been given a shower when in fact she had not been showered at all, because they had left it up to a 7 or 8 year old to do this, you know, massive job of trying to detangle this little girl's matted hair. It was outrageous.
Professor Binford, where are these children coming from? Why are they separated from their parents? Where are their parents?
So about half the children have parents in the United States. So as we started to interview the children, we asked them where their parents were. We asked them if they had their parents' telephone number. And most of the children have parents in the United States. Most of the children that I interviewed have children in the United States. And they had their parents' number either memorized or written on a bracelet around their arms or tucked into a piece of paper in their jacket. And so we asked them if they'd like to speak to their parents, if they had spoken to their parents. And many of these children had not spoken to their parents. And many of these children who had spoken to their parents had only spoken to them once. So what we did was we got the parents on the phone and started to find out what had happened. And many of these children are coming from Central America, particularly the Northern Triangle, which is El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras. And they came to the United States with relatives. This might be a parent, but it might be the entire family. We had one little girl who was separated from her mother, her father, and her younger sibling. We had many children who had been separated from older siblings who are young adults. We had children who were separated from aunts and uncles and cousins. And then what's happening is they are being reclassified as unaccompanied children, even though they came across with relatives and have parents in the United States. Over 50% of these children last year were placed with their parents in the United States. Another 20-something percent were placed with other family members in the United States, and an additional approximately 15% were placed with other adults who are authorized by the parents to take care of them. So it's really a very small percentage, about 12% of the children that we meet with in these facilities who actually need to be in government custody. Every other child can be put on an airplane to their parents, or their parents are willing to come and get them. We repeatedly talked to the parents who said, tell me where I need to send the money to bring my daughter to me, to bring my son to me. You know, they are able to take care of their children. They want to take care of their children. The only thing that's standing between these children and their parents is the U.S. government. And I've described for you the horrendous conditions in which the U.S. government is keeping these children.
What is the outrageous Trump administration telling you?
Well, you know, the Trump administration is telling us that they are overwhelmed, that there's too much chaos, that there are too many people coming across the border. And frankly, there is chaos, but it is the chaos that has been created by this administration. We are nowhere near the highest level of apprehensions that have been taken by the Border Patrol over the last several decades. So the numbers that we're seeing come in are not the highest numbers that we've seen. And when they say that, it's simply not true. We are seeing a higher number, a higher level of children and young families coming across the border, young mothers and their babies coming across the border, or young children coming across the border, and then some older unaccompanied children. However, we have facilities to take care of them. And as I mentioned earlier, most of these children have family in the United States who can care for them. So the administration currently has 12,000 beds online where they can take care of these children. Three quarters of those beds are in licensed facilities so that we have some assurance that these children can be relatively well cared for in these facilities compared to what they're experiencing in Border Patrol. We currently have approximately 2,000 empty beds in those facilities, and children only need to be in those facilities for a few days, no more than 20 days. So if the administration would simply manage the resources it has, it can move these children in and out of Border Patrol facilities in a matter of hours, in and out of the Office of Refugee Resettlement beds, you know, those facilities in a matter of days. No more than 20 days is what's allowed by law, and into the homes with their families where it will cost the taxpayer no money to take care of these children. Keep in mind that these facilities that the administration has set up for these kids is costing the American taxpayer $775 a day, which is an outrageous amount of money
for
us. Yes, per kid, which is an outrageous amount of money when these children have family in the United States that want to take care of them and are ready to take care of them. All we have to do is let the parents and their families have these children back.
Is the Trump administration, we just have 30 seconds, breaking the law? For example, the Flores Agreement.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. This is why we went to the media, is that they are absolutely breaking the law. They're breaking the law as to the conditions of detention. They're breaking the law as to the number of hours that they can keep the children in Border Patrol facilities. They're breaking the law as far as how long these children are being kept in ORR facilities. They're breaking the law by taking the children away from their families. And they're also breaking the law by transporting them on Texas state highways without the appropriate child seats and infant carriers and, you know, these booster seats that are required by law. Everywhere I look, this administration is breaking the law. And the Border Patrol employees that we talked to said they don't understand why the American people aren't outraged by the mismanagement that they're experiencing.
Warren Binford, we want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank
law
you.
Professor at Willamette University, director of its clinical law program, one of the experts asked to serve on the monitoring team for the Flores case. When we come back, elderly Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II, go back to one of those camps in Oklahoma, what they call concentration camps, incarceration camps, because the Trump administration plans to put hundreds of migrant children there. Stay with us. And Fears by Gabby Moreno. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to a dramatic scene that unfolded Saturday when five Japanese-American elders, survivors of the U.S. internment camps, engaged in civil disobedience outside the Fort Sill Army Post in Oklahoma, where the Trump administration plans to indefinitely detain 1,400 immigrant and refugee children starting next month. Fort Sill was an internment camp for 700 Japanese-American men in 1942. It was one of more than 70 sites where the U.S. government incarcerated about 120 120,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans during World War II, including one of 14 U.S. Army bases. President Obama first used Fort Sill in 2014 to detain migrant children seeking asylum from violence in Central America. Last December, Jacqueline Kahl, a 7-year-old Guatemalan girl, became one of 6 children to die in Border Patrol custody in less than a year after she was held in a Customs and Border Patrol facility near the site of another former U.S. internment camp in Lordsburg, New Mexico. Well, Democracy Now! Was there in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, on Saturday when the Japanese-American elders incarcerated in these camps risked arrest to protest along with descendants of survivors.
My name is Satsuki Ina. I'm a former child incarceree during World War II. This is a photograph of me when I was imprisoned. 75 years ago, 120,000 of us were removed from our homes and forcefully incarcerated in prison camps across the country. We're here today to protest the repetition of history. We were in American concentration camps. We were held under indefinite detention. We were without due process of law. We were charged without any evidence of being a threat to national security, that we were an unassimilable race, that we would be a threat to the economy. We hear these exact words today regarding innocent people seeking asylum in this country. And unlike 1942, when America turned their back on us while we were disappearing from our homes, our schools, our farms, and our jobs, we're here today to speak out, to protest the unjust incarceration of innocent people seeking refuge in this country. We stand with them, and we are saying, stop repeating history.
My name is Kiyoshi Ina. I'm from Concord, California, and I spent the first 4.5 years in a concentration camp. I was born in Topaz, Utah, and I'm here to protest against the incarceration of the immigrant children here at Fort Sill.
I'm Nikki Nojima Lewis, and on December 7th, 1941, in Seattle, Washington, I was celebrating my 4th birthday when the FBI interrupted my birthday party and removed my father to Lordsburg, New Mexico, the DOJ camp, and subsequently Santa Fe, New Mexico. My mother and I were incarcerated at the Puyallup Fairgrounds called Camp Harmony and later in Minidoka, Idaho.
You cannot protest on Fort Sill. If you want to protest, you have to go across the street, the highway, and that needs to happen right now. Let's go, let's go, let's go, now, today.
My name is Chizu Omori.
Say a couple more statements,
no,
please.
No, ma'am, you may not. You may, I will say it, this is the last time. You cannot protest on Fort Sill. You need to move across the street now.
Chizu, were you going to make a statement?
Go ahead, Chizu.
Yes.
Apparently, you didn't hear what I said.
I'm sorry, sir.
You need to move today, now, right now. Move.
Otherwise, what will happen?
I don't know. No, I'm not going to arrest you, but you need to move now.
Thank you. Continue. Then we're not going to move.
Yes, you're going to move.
If you're not going to arrest us, we're not going to move.
Go ahead. Okay, yes. Yes, I spent 3.5 years at Poston, Arizona, an American concentration camp during World War II, and I'm here to bear witness to the travesty of the American justice system, in that the family separation policy, which is ruining the lives of these children. I'm very incensed about the government policy of separating parents, and we the people have to stand up and protest this.
My name's Tom Ikeda. I'm the executive director of Densho. It's a nonprofit in Seattle. And one of the things that Densho does is we're the story keepers for the community, especially what happened during World War II. And so I came here to honor the story of Kanesaburo Oshima, who was shot and killed here. 9 years ago, I interviewed his son in Kona, Hawaii, and he told me how this man with 11 children and businesses in Kona was taken for no crime and brought here. And the trauma of being here, the stress, he ended up essentially, as his son said, snapped. And he started climbing the fence in broad daylight saying, I want to go home. And as the other internees said, don't shoot, a guard came up and shot him in the back of his head and killed him. And so in his honor, I'm here to remember Kanesaburo Oshima.
My name is Paul Tomita. I'm from Seattle, Washington. This is me. In 1943, as a four-year-old.
It's English. Get out.
And so what we did with here is I had to have this to get out of Minidoka.
Look. I understand your issues, okay? But you cannot protest on Fort Sill.
All of our elders who are incarceration survivors have stated publicly that they are willing to be arrested in defense of the children who are going to be brought here.
Minute.
Satsuki, can you please describe what's happening now?
They're wanting us to, they're wanting to remove us. We've been removed too many times. If that's what it comes to.
People understand.
We will stay here and,
What don't you people understand?
We understand the whole history of this country, and we aren't going to let it happen again. What were you saying, Satsuki?
That we want to make a stand. We want to say that we are protesting the fact that 1,400 children are going to be brought to this military site. We're here because we do not want to have that happen. And as former children of prison camps, of concentration camps in America, we are saying no more, never again.
That was the scene at Fort Sill Army Post in Oklahoma Saturday, where Japanese-American survivors of U.S. internment camps, which they called concentration camps, risked arrest Saturday to protest the detention of migrant children there at Fort Sill starting next month. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by one of the organizers. First, I want to turn to some of the Oklahoma residents who joined in the protest in solidarity at a nearby park Saturday. Some drew attention to how Fort Sill was also used to incarcerate Native Americans and housed a boarding school for Native children separated from their families. Early in its history, it served as a prisoner of war camp for some 300 members of the Chiricahua Apache tribe who were forcibly relocated from the Southwest in 1894. Including the Apache leader Geronimo. We begin with Reverend Sherry Dickerson of Black Lives Matter Oklahoma addressing the crowd.
I've served in the military, and I did so proudly. But I want to tell you, if you are some of my former military or veteran brothers and sisters, that if you are holding an American flag today, or if you are holding an Oklahoma flag, it should be upside down. Because we are in distress.
My name is Edson. I am with Dream Action Oklahoma, which is an immigration advocacy organization here in Oklahoma. The United States began with a declaration that the people who have lived here are merciless savages. Marking their bodies is only something to be exterminated, removed, and conquered. And thus, they tried and they did. That is the reality of the land in which we live. In Fort Sill, you can see that in action throughout time. With Geronimo being held, now being used as the very idea of enemy combatant, as it was mentioned, that's what they called Osama bin Laden when they killed him.
My name is Heta. I'm glad to be here. I'm a Kiowa woman from the Kiowa tribe. I guess you could say I am a descendant of a Fort Sill Indian School atrocity. 1871, it was established at Fort Sill. It was established there because they were, as the people were saying earlier, they were snatched from their homes to try and do something for them, because they always looked at us and looked down on us that we were stupid, that we couldn't do nothing, that we didn't know nothing. But you know what? That was a lie. I graduated from Lawton MacArthur. Okay, I didn't say Fort Sill Indian School. I graduated from Lawton MacArthur on the east side of town. And what that was, that individual was kind of like giving us lies, smoothing it over. And after I had graduated, I found out that we were guinea pigs for the government, education-wise. Because they were still trying to think that they're going to make us better or be like them. And it didn't work. Because we still have our language. We still have our dances. We still have our songs. We still are still here. I'm here to talk about them. That was my experience, but mainly I'm here today because of the children. The children are always near to my heart, no matter who they are. And no matter where, you know, and I seen this. This was given to me, and I said that I was going to be here today, not knowing I was going to be doing this. But my heart breaks for the atrocities that they're going through. And I see, because I know what it's like to be abused as a child.
We just want to thank Nicole and the ACLU, because they have been our working ground partners here.
I think that when they were trying to decide where they would detain children, it's not accident that they picked Oklahoma. We lead the nation in rate of incarceration of people overall. We lead the nation in rate of incarceration of black people. The number of indigenous people in prisons in Oklahoma has increased by 46% between the years 2008 and 2015. What they did not count on is community. They think by assaulting us on all fronts, they can divide people. But I think today is just a small showing that people in Oklahoma care, that we're willing to fight, that we're willing to come together.
Oklahoma residents protesting in solidarity with Japanese American elders who are survivors of U.S. internment camps, which they call concentration camps. Special thanks to Renee Feltz and Hani Massoud for that report. But for more on Saturday's protests against the detention of migrant children at Fort Sill Army Base planned for next month, we're joined by Mike Ishii, co-chair of Tsudu for Solidarity, who helped organize Saturday's Oklahoma protest. His mother, incarcerated at the so-called Camp Harmony Holding Center at Puyallup, Washington, and then Camp Minidoka in Idaho during World War II. Michael Ishii, it's great to have you with us. The significance of these elders traveling from where they live in California and other places to Oklahoma, what happened at Fort Sill?
What happened was that there was an activation and a unification of the outrage of a generation of children that were incarcerated in U.S. concentration camps. They found their voices, and they're coming forward into the public to defend children.
And the Fort Sill security tried to stop it from happening. This was a kind of civil disobedience they engaged in, because you saw the security coming up and saying they had to leave.
Absolutely. We had a meeting beforehand, and they all stepped forward and they said, I'm willing to be arrested. This is important enough.
And why is it so important to you?
Well, my family was incarcerated. I grew up in a family that had members murdered in upstate New York by people who were racist. My whole family
was after World War II, your Japanese-American great-uncle. was
yes,
murdered.
Yes, actually, it was during the war. My family was in Minidoka in Idaho, the camp, and they heard a report on the news that they realized, oh, this is our family that had been murdered upstate New York. Yeah. So but this is not an unusual story. These are the stories of concentration camps and incarceration in the United States. There's a historical pattern of detention and separation of families that we're seeing across the United States, affecting immigrant communities and affecting communities of color.
And the debate over whether you can call them concentration camps, it's clearly the language that each of the elders used.
Absolutely. What you know, they live this experience, so they can speak with moral authority. But these are people who, they were rounded up based on their race. There was no due process. They were put in behind barbed wire or in detention centers, and they were held there by armed guards, not unlike what we're seeing in Clint right now in Texas or in all of these other detention sites for children.
1,400 children are slated to be sent to Fort Sill, where some Japanese Americans were sent during World War II.
Absolutely.
We'll continue to follow the story and bring out the voices of those who are protesting. Michael Ishii, co-chair of Tsuru for Solidarity, helped organize Saturday's protests against the detention of migrant children at Fort Sill Army Base. We will post part two of our interview with Mike Ishii at democracynow.org. When we come back, we go to Ecuador to speak with the Swedish computer programmer Ola Binni, who was just released from jail after being held for 2 months without charge, detained in Ecuador. And the same day, his friend Julian Assange was arrested and forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Stay with us. Summer of 42 by Kishibashi. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Quito, Ecuador, where we're joined by Ola Binni, a Swedish programmer and data privacy activist who was recently freed after spending more than 2 months in an Ecuadorian jail without charge. Ola Binni is a friend of WikiLeaks editor Julian Assange. He was arrested in Quito April 11th, the same day Assange was forcibly taken by British authorities from the Ecuadorian embassy in London to the Belmarsh prison, where he is incarcerated today. On Thursday, Ola Binni briefly spoke to reporters after a judge ordered his release.
We have proven my innocence for the first time, and we will continue to prove my innocence. I want to thank the judges for showing what we've been saying the whole time, that this process has been illegal and that I was illegally detained.
Ola Binni has lived in Ecuador for 5 years, where he's worked at the Quito-based Center for Digital Autonomy. During that time, he also traveled to London to meet with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy. This all comes as Ecuador's right-wing president, Lenin Moreno, is facing a corruption probe after the leak of internal documents exposed he had secretly set up multiple offshore bank accounts. Moreno has accused WikiLeaks of being involved in the leak. Ola Binni has been accused of hacking the Ecuadorian government, but no charges have been filed against him. He remains under investigation, has been barred from leaving Ecuador. The United States has also expressed interest in Binni's case. The Associated Press reported earlier this month the U.S. Justice Department has received permission from Ecuadorian authorities to question him. Ola Binni joins us now from Quito, Ecuador. Ola, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about your release and what you, I was going to say, are being charged with, but you haven't been charged? Why were you arrested?
Hello, Amy. It's great to be here again, and it's great to hear you. Why was I arrested? That's a very, very good question. We don't know. We're still trying to get an answer to this. In fact, through the whole process, 70 days in prison and all the days since, we have been asking the prosecution to tell us what it is I have done, and they still haven't actually given us any single answer. So getting released, getting a tribunal telling us that that they accepted our habeas corpus, that my detention and arrest was illegal, has been a very, very good victory for us, showing that what we have been saying from the beginning, that this process has simply not been regularly done. And we're still waiting to understand what it is I'm supposed to have done.
You were arrested just after Julian Assange was taken forcibly out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London. So I assume you had seen those images. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I woke up on the early morning on Thursday, April 11th, and I received the news about what happened to Julian. And then a few hours later, I went to the airport because I had a previously planned trip to Japan. And I was planning on leaving purely on coincidence the same day. And when I went to the gate, when I came to the gate, I was detained by people who said they were police officers, but not providing any identification.
Do you believe your arrest is connected to Julian Assange?
At this point, I have no idea why it happened the same day. The prosecution has tried to introduce Julian Assange as a component of my of the case he's trying to make against me, but no strict connections have been made so far, so we don't know.
Did they take all of your equipment, your electronic equipment? Did they take your phone, your computer?
Yes.
And what do you understand
has
happened to
it? Yes, they took all of my equipment. So they took all of my equipment that I had with me when I was at the airport. And later during the night, they actually took me to the outside of my apartment. They told me they had an order to enter my apartment, but they never showed the order to enter my apartment. And they asked if I was willing to help them come in and voluntarily help them. I said I needed my lawyer to do that. And they denied. They ignored that request and entered without my permission. And as far as I know, all of my technical equipment in my apartment has been taken. They have also taken about 14 or 15 books that are primarily about computer science. And this was presented during the first hearing. In terms of what has happened with it, we've had several hearings at the forensics lab here in Quito, where they have asked me to provide the passwords for my devices. I have refused to provide the passwords, primarily because they still haven't told me what I've done. So what I've told the prosecutor is, once they tell me what I've done, when I've done it, how I've done it, where I've done it, I will consider helping them. But until then, we are not going to do that. The last hearing we had, the technical division said that they don't know how to open my devices and they were going to ask for international help. And that's the last official information that we have about this.
So, Olabini, there have been reports that U.S. investigators have been granted permission by Ecuador to question you. Associated Press reports you're due to be questioned on, June 27th. Can you explain what is the role of the United States in your arrest?
So, first of all, I received the request to interview me on Tuesday in this week. This was a request from the Ecuadorian judiciary, and when you receive that kind of request, you cannot deny it. So I was planning on presenting myself and going there with my lawyer and see what questions they were going to ask. However, on Friday, we found out that the United States government has actually withdrawn their request, and they are now not interested in asking me any questions anymore, apparently.
Now, I understood that some of Julian Assange's or all of his equipment, the Ecuadorian government had perhaps given it to the British government from the Ecuadorian embassy, where he lived for about 7 years. Do you know if your equipment has been handed to the United States?
As far as I know, it's still here in Quito. That's the only legal way. And as far as I know, it wouldn't be legal for the prosecution to send it anywhere else.
Are you a member of WikiLeaks? You clearly know Julian Assange. You visited him in the embassy where he had political asylum by Ecuador under the previous president.
Julian Assange is only a friend of mine. I have never worked with Julian. I've never worked with WikiLeaks, and I am categorically not a member of WikiLeaks, and I have never been a member of WikiLeaks.
Can you explain what the Ecuadorian government has accused you of, the president, what he has accused you of, why he is so concerned about a document leak?
Yeah, this is a little bit confusing because, of course, the prosecution hasn't accused me of anything. In fact, I'm being investigated under what's called a delito. And this delito, or a statute, is basically just a category of a type of crime. And this crime is basically that I have in some way adversely impacted the integrity of computer systems. But what that actually means with computer systems that I have impacted in any way, we have no idea. Now, of course, the president has gone on TV and saying that I have done things like breaking into computer systems, breaking into mobile phones and stealing documents.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we'll do part two and post online at democracynow.org. Ola Bini, thanks for joining us.